University faculty in the U.S. are married to fellow academics. As Valentine's Day approaches, four married UVM staff couples reflect on their relationships and how they're found and how they found their way to UVM. So you can go online and read the rest of the story. It's pretty cool. It's Valentine's Day, isn't it? So 9 o'clock at WRUV. Let's look at the weather. So Friday, which is today, the 14th, it's going to be mostly cloudy, a low of 6 degrees Fahrenheit. Tomorrow, there's going to be PM snow shower. It says 2.5 inches, high of 23, a low of 18. On Sunday, the 16th, just says snow, no qualifications, up to 10 inches here. That's a lot of snow. So highs are going to be 25, low 13 on Sunday. So look out for driving on Sunday. On Monday, it's just going to be cloudy, regular old cloudy, high of 19, a low of 6 degrees. So you're listening to WRUV FM Burlington. This is, you're listening to Radio Lyceum. That's the name of the show. I'm James. You can call us here at 656-4399. That's the telephone number. You can also message me in the little chat thing that's on our website at wruv.org if you want to. And there's a email for this radio program, radiolyceum@protonmail.com. If you have any, I'm reaching out for nonprofits that have community members that are volunteering. We're trying to bring them on and be like, promote them. And hey, it's a promote the fun that you could have hanging out with these people that are doing volunteering or just hanging out. It could be whatever. It could be your ping pong league. Doesn't even need to be a nonprofit. If you have like this wicked ping pong league or a foosball league that you want to promote, hey, come on, we could talk about it. I'm not sure how much you can talk about foosball. We could maybe broadcast a match, just, you know, back and forth, many people screaming like, oh, for that's probably like 5 hours, not five minutes of entertainment, maybe, but we're throwing stuff out there. So let's play you a public service announcement because it's the top of the hour. We have to do that kind of thing here, and we'll get into lethality of loneliness. Sounds lethal. Sounds kind of depressing. It's not. It's actually pretty good. And then we'll go on to talking about how to engage in small talk, which even as you, me talking to you in this non-small talk area, it's very good advice that that they cover. So public service announcement. Keep on listening. You better alternative, WRUV FM Burlington.
To make sure you're well rested before you get behind the wheel. According to the National Sleep Foundation, driving tired can be almost as dangerous as driving drunk. The best way to prevent drowsy driving is to make sure you get enough sleep, around 7 to 9 hours a day for most adults. If you find yourself tired behind the wheel, pull over at the nearest safe place and take a nap. This message is brought to you by your Wide Awake DJs and 90.1 WRUV FM Burlington.
When you look out onto the world, it certainly appears the earth is flat. The ground beneath you is stable and unmoving, and the stars and suns circle the earth. Hundreds of years ago, elaborate theories were developed based on these common sense observations to explain and predict the reach of the oceans and the movements of celestial bodies. When science demonstrated that these common sense observations were illusions and depicted the earth and the universe in an completely different way, people slowly came to accept that the world was not as it seemed. Scientific measurements and sophisticated calculations have repeatedly demonstrated that what we think is intuitive, obvious, and common sense cannot be trusted to be true. For that reason, Modern science is based on a denial of common sense. Until apparently it comes to ourselves. When science confirms a particular way of thinking about our mind and behavior, or depicts it in an unusual and new way, we tend to be skeptical that such a science is worthwhile, even if possible. And instead, we fall back on intuition, prior beliefs, and yes, common sense. For instance, if I told you scientific research has demonstrated that opposites attract, wouldn't you tell me that we don't need a science that tells us something we already know? But what if I told you that birds of a feather flock together according to scientific research? Wouldn't you say, we don't need a science to tell us something that we already know? Well, you may have realized already, of course, that these both may be self-evident truths, but they can't both be true since they're internally inconsistent. The science of mind and behavior is full of such examples, self-evident truths that both can't be true. We know, for instance, that two heads are better than one, and we know that too many cooks spoil the broth. The next time you hear a science report of some obvious result, remember that the opposite result was equally obvious but had just been proven to be wrong. It's obvious that we're rugged individualists. True. We're born to the most prolonged period of dependency, but in our transition to adulthood, we achieve autonomy, independence. We become kings of the mountain, captains of our universe. It's easy to think about our brain housed deep within a cranial vault, separated, isolated, protected from others. When we look out into the social world, other individuals certainly look distinct, independent, selfish entities with no forces binding them together. No wonder that we forget that we're a member of a social species, born dependent on our parents. For our species to survive, these infants must instantly engage their parents in protective behavior, and the parents must care enough about these offspring to nurture and protect them. Even once grown, we're not particularly splendid specimens. Other animals can run faster, see and smell better, and fight much more effectively than we can. Our evolutionary advantage is our brain and our ability to communicate, plan, reason, and work together. Our survival depends on our collective abilities, not on our individual might. We are connected across our lifespan to one another through a myriad of invisible forces that, like gravity, are ubiquitous and powerful. After all, social species, by definition, create emergent structures that extend beyond an organism. Structures that range from couples and families to schools and nations and cultures. These structures evolved hand in hand with neural, hormonal, and genetic mechanisms to support them because the consequent social behavior helped these organisms survive, reproduce, and leave a genetic legacy. To grow to an adulthood for a social species, including humans, is not to become autonomous and solitary, it's to become the one on whom others can depend. Whether we know it or not, our brain and biology have been shaped to favor this outcome. The evolutionary biologist David Sloan Wilson notes that if you ask people, what are the traits of a good person? You hear traits such as kind, generous, compassionate, and empathic. If you ask people, what are the traits of an evil person? You hear traits such as cruel, greedy, exploitive, and selfish. Said differently, the traits of a good person depict someone who cares about themselves and others. And an evil person cares about themselves at the expense of others. Across our biological heritage, our brain and biology has been sculpted to incline us towards certain ways of feeling, thinking, and behaving. For instance, we have a number of biological machineries that capitalize on aversive signals to motivate us to act in ways that are essential for our survival. Hunger, for instance, is triggered by low blood sugar and motivates you to eat, an important early warning system for an organism that required much more time and effort to find food than going to the refrigerator door, kitchen cabinet, or fast food restaurant. Thirst is an aversive signal that motivates us to search for drinkable water prior to falling victim to dehydration. And pain is an aversive system that notifies us of potential tissue damage and motivates us to take care of our physical body. You might think that the biological warning machinery stops there, but there's more. Although not common sense, although not intuitive, the pain and aversiveness of loneliness, of feeling isolated from those around you, is also part of a biological early warning machinery to alert you to threats and damage to your social body, which you also need to survive and prosper. Now, just about all of us have felt physical pain, and nearly all of us have felt the heartbreak of homesickness, the agony of bereavement, the torment of unrequited love, and the pain of being shunned. All of these are variations on the experience of loneliness. When I started to study the effects of loneliness in brain biology a couple of decades ago, loneliness had been characterized as a gnawing chronic disease without redeeming features. It was even equated with shyness and depression, with being a loner, a person with marginal social skills. Scientific measurements and sophisticated calculations, to our surprise, revealed that these were myths. Science and common sense had again produced two very different depictions of a phenomenon. And yet, if you look at the way we are increasingly living our lives, it shows the extent to which we still buy into those myths of loneliness and values of autonomy and independence. For instance, if you look at the percent of one-person households in 1940 across the United States, it was largely less than 15% of the households by state. Fast forward to 1970, and it's grown to be between 15 and 20%. Fast forward to 2000, and it now exceeds 25% in most states in America. And that light blue state, Utah, in the 2010 census has gone darker blue. The prevalence of loneliness is also on the rise. In the 1980s, scholars estimated that about 20% of Americans felt lonely at any given point in time. Two recent nationally representative surveys indicate that this number has doubled. But you don't hear people talking about feeling lonely. And that's because loneliness is stigmatized, the psychological equivalent of being a loser in life or a weak person. And this is truly unfortunate, because it means we're more likely to deny feeling lonely, which makes no more sense than denying we feel hunger, thirst, or pain. For living with loneliness, we now know, is a major risk factor for broad-based morbidity and mortality. Consider a couple of the conditions we know about premature death. Living with air pollution increases your odds of an early death by 5%. Living with obesity, we know, a national health problem, increases your odds of an early death by 20%. Excessive alcohol consumption, 30%. A recent meta-analysis of over 100,000 participants shows that living with loneliness increases your odds of an early death by 45%. We're not the only social species, and in experimental investigations of non-human social animals who were isolated shows they too suffer deleterious physiological consequences and an abbreviated lifespan. Across our history as a species, we have survived and prospered by banding together, couples, families, and tribes for mutual protection and assistance. We think of loneliness as a sad condition, but for social species, being on the social perimeter is not only sad, it is dangerous. The brains of social species, including our own, have evolved to respond to being on the social perimeter by going into a self-preservation mode. If you isolate a rodent and then put it in an open field, such as this box in the bottom of the image, it engages in what's called predator evasion. It walks around the outside and doesn't venture into the middle, where escape from a flying predator would be more difficult. When humans feel isolated, they too are not only in an unhappy circumstance, but in a dangerous circumstance. And their brains too snap into a self-preservation mode. In a brain imaging study that we conducted, we showed people negative images that had nothing to do with other people or negative social images while they were sitting in a scanner and we were scanning. What we found was the lonelier the brain, when a negative social image was presented, that is, in a person's environment, when something negative socially happened, the brain allocated more attention, greater visual cortical activity, depicted in yellow here, to that image. Now, as you follow that image forward, you come to those two blue areas. That's the temporal parietal junction. This is a piece of brain tissue that's involved in theory of mind, in mind reading, in mentalizing, in taking another person's perspective, in empathy. It's responsible for the attentional control required to step out of your head and put yourself, at least figuratively, inside the head of someone else so you can take their point of view. The lonelier the brain, when something negative in the social context was depicted, the less the activation in this region. It's dangerous on the social perimeter. When something happens negative in the social environment, that brain is focused on self-preservation, not a concern of the other person. The similarity in neural and behavioral effects across phylogeny is a testament to the importance of the social environment for social species. And these deep evolutionary roots, tilting our brain in biology towards self-preservation, also suggests that much of what's triggered by social isolation is non-conscious. For instance, when you feel isolated, you feel this motive, this desire, this intention to connect with other people again. What you don't feel is that your brain has gone into a hypervigilance for social threats. And this hypervigilance means you introduce attentional, confirmatory, and even memory biases in terms of those social interactions. And if you're looking for dangers, you're more likely to see dangers whether they exist or not, meaning that you're more likely to have negative interactions. And that threat surveillance of always looking for the next foe activates neurobiological mechanisms that can degrade your health and lead to early mortality. Loneliness increases defensiveness because you're focused on your own welfare rather than taking the position or perspective of people with whom you interact. Loneliness increases depressive symptoms, which has the odd effect of decreasing your likelihood of having social conflict, and through the acoustic and postural and facial expressions of sadness, such as this child in this picture, serves as a signal to others in the vicinity to reconnect with you if they're willing to do so. So it's a safe call for connection. Loneliness increases morning cortisol levels, a powerful stress hormone, the consequence of the brain's preparation for yet another dangerous day. And loneliness increases prepotent responding, which means you're more likely to fall victim to a whole host of unhealthy, impulsive behaviors. And the end of the day doesn't bring an end to the brain's high alert state. If it's dangerous to fend off wild beasts by yourself with a stick, imagine how dangerous it is to lay that stick down at night when predators are out and you're without that safe social surround. We have found that loneliness also decreases sleep salubrity, increases the number of microawakenings, increases the fragmentation of sleep, and thereby decreases the detoxification of stressful days over the course of the night. Loneliness even alters gene expression, such as inflammatory biology, to deal with assaults. Not long ago, we thought about the genes as the keyboard on which life's song played out. What this research suggests is that if the genes are the keys on the piano, then the environment, including your social environment, is the pianist influencing which keys are turned on and off. Well, if loneliness is dangerous, what can we do about it? When we're hungry, we can go to the refrigerator and get a snack. When we're thirsty, we can go to the faucet and draw a glass of water. But when we're lonely, we have no pantry full of friends with whom we can connect. And no, online social networking does not replace the comforting touch of a friend. First, recognize what the signal is and don't deny it. Second, understand what it does to your brain, to your body, to your behavior. It's dangerous as a member of a social species to feel isolated, and our brain snaps into a self-preservation mode. That brings with it some unwanted and unknown effects on our thoughts and our actions toward others. Be aware of those, understand those effects, and take responsibility for your actions toward others. And third, respond. Understanding that it's not the quantity of friends, it's the quality of a few relationships that actually matter. Attend to the three components of connectedness. One can promote intimate connections by developing one individual who's trusted, in whom you can confide, and who can confide in you. You can promote relational connections by simply sharing good times with friends and family. We often go to the dinner table happy that we've provided for our family, but having forgotten to share any good times with them en route. Collective connectedness can be promoted by becoming a part of something bigger than yourselves. If the obstacles to connection seem insurmountable, consider volunteering for something that you enjoy, perhaps helping to serve the needy, volunteering in a museum, a zoo, a running club, or a TEDx event, or simply taking time to speak to elders at a retirement home. Sharing good times is one of the keys to connection. And don't wait. The next time you feel alienated, isolated, or excluded, respond to that aversive signal as you would hunger, thirst, and pain, and get connected.
So you were just listening to The Lethality of Loneliness by John Caspio Poe. It's an Italian name. Sorry, guys. Sorry, I don't speak Italian. But a very good talk, basically laying out like the effects and how it's bad. But moving on to Matt Abrams, to get good at small talk and even enjoy it. So this is kind of a positive way. I'll cut in through the midway and just make some commentary and maybe some tips of my own. So let's play a little transitional track and then we'll get right to Matt Abrams. You're listening to WRV FM Burlington.
Small talk, I think, is actually a misnomer. We'll be right back. Small talk, I think, is actually a misnomer. We refer to small talk as any chit-chat or just conversation that we don't put a lot of import on. When in fact, small talk is a wonderful way of connecting, bonding, learning, growing. What makes it so challenging is the fact that we can't have a script. We have to just go with what's happening in the moment. We often think that it is a test for us. It's like a tennis match where I've got to lob something over to the person or people I'm talking to, and I hope it lands and goes well. I think a better way to look at small talk is like that game of hacky sack, that little beanbag where everybody's trying to keep it up all at the same time and never have it hit the ground. If you envision your job as collaborating with others to keep the conversation moving, rather than a hot potato tennis match where I just need to get it back to the other person, it can really change, one, how it flows, and two, the experience from your perspective. All of a sudden, it's something that's enjoyable rather than something that's scary. When you first get into a small talk situation, I think we need to establish appropriate goals. Rachel Greenwald, a matchmaker and an academic, has this wonderful saying, your goal is to be interested, not interesting. A lot of us go into these situations thinking that we need to be really fascinating, engaging, and interesting, when in fact, we just need to be present and be interested in the conversation that's happening. It also helps reduce the anxiety many of us feel. We feel like we are being judged, and the reality is you are being judged. You can reduce the intensity of that spotlight we feel by putting your attention on the other. Many of us have this desire as soon as something spontaneous happens and we have to respond, to do it as quickly as possible. We have this sense that speed to respond in somehow is associated with competence. But really what reflects best on your competence is an appropriate response. And appropriateness can take a little bit of time. We have all said something we didn't mean to say because it wasn't clear, it wasn't appropriate. Pausing helps reduce that likelihood. So here are some things you can do to help slow yourself down. Paraphrasing is wonderful. Why? Not just because you are repeating the gist of what somebody said to make sure you're clearly going to respond to what's asked or what's needed, but paraphrasing forces you to slow down and listen more carefully. Paraphrase isn't what a five-year-old does who parrots back what you've said. It's a distillation of what the other person said, and when you paraphrase it, you do several things. One, you validate the other person because you're saying, I heard you. You're not necessarily agreeing. Paraphrasing doesn't mean agreement, it just means this is what I heard. And it validates the content. So you validate the person, but the content, the person can say, no, what I really meant was this. So it helps with fidelity. Most of us listen just enough to get the gist of what somebody's saying, and then we immediately start judging, rehearsing, and responding. When I paraphrase, I have to listen super intently. I have to listen to understand what's the bottom line of what you're saying. That slows me down. And by slowing my own thoughts down and then paraphrasing them, I buy myself some time to really think. There's always something to say. You can always ask a question. My mother-in-law was amazing at small talk. She had a black belt in small talk. And her superpower was a simple phrase. She would pause for a moment and she would say, "Tell me more." If you are ever in a situation, a communication conversation, where you don't know what to say, most of the time you could simply say, tell me more, or give me some more detail, or what did you mean about that point? And just by giving the person an opportunity to speak again, that gives you time to find what you might want to say and to connect to it.
Tell me more.
When you say tell me more, you have to act inquisitively. If you just say, okay, tell me more, it's not, but if you say, tell me more. You know, tell me more about that. Yeah. Mistakes are normal and natural in communication. We make them all the time. Spontaneous communication is about connection, not perfection. You know, in film and TV, directors will ask their actors to have multiple takes. A take is just another shot at doing the same thing. So an actor might say something in one way very passionately, or they might say it in another way, being more curious. Those are all different takes. So I'd like people to reframe a mistake as a missed take. What you did wasn't wrong. There might be another way to do it, and we can try it again.
So I just wanted to cut in and talk about that. So you can also, like, you could take the mistake as an opportunity to highlight your playfulness and lean into the mistake, or if it's really bad, you might have to say sorry or something. But generally, that's my strategy, because I say stupid stuff all the time. So I just kind of be like, hey, just highlight it. People find funny. It could be hard if you're nervous. I get nervous sometimes. And I know most people are going to be, can understand your nervousness, so don't let that get in your head. And people like other humans, not robots. So if you speak perfectly all the time, like Dan Rather, if anyone remembers who Dan Rather is, probably not. No one likes to talk to Dan Rather if he's talking to a newscaster in real life. So just keep that in mind.
Many of us, when we feel very uncomfortable in spontaneous speaking situations, we go on too long. We're discovering what we're thinking as we're thinking it. So we just take people on the journey of our thought process as we're speaking, and we keep going on and on and on. It's almost a defensive technique, where if I just throw out a lot of stuff, that maybe something will stick, and people will think, oh, that person's smart, or they know what they're talking about. Concision is almost always better in communication. My mother has this wonderful saying. I know she didn't create it, but it's, tell me the time, don't build me the clock. Many of us are clock builders in these spontaneous speaking situations. And we have to remind ourselves when we start speaking, just tell the time. I know the irony that I'm talking about concision, and I was not concise in that answer.
So, yeah, I fall into that trap all the time. I'm immune to most pressure. Social anxiety, not immune to that. So I could fall in the trap of rambling on. Take deep breaths. Leave some space for our people to step in and look into your eyes and be like, what the heck are you talking about? Slow down. That's generally a good technique. Yeah.
One of the best ways to be concise and clear is to leverage structure. Structure is not a listing of ideas. It's not bullet points. Structure is a logical connection of your points. It's like a recipe or a map. Now, this sounds ironic, right? We're talking about being spontaneous, and here I am saying structure is the key to spontaneity. But we see this in our life in many other facets. If you enjoy jazz music isn't just random playing. Jazz music follows particular structures, chord progressions, connections of notes. So we can leverage structure to help our communication be tighter and clearer. One of my favorite structures of all time, because it's so useful in so many different situations, is three simple questions. What, so what, now what? The what is your idea, your product, your service, your belief. The so what is, why is it important to the person or people you're talking to? And the now what is what comes next. Maybe I'm going to show you something, take your questions, set up another appointment. When it comes to small talk, this is a magical tool. Imagine you're at a corporate mixer and you're going in and there are people in the company that you have not yet met. So if I'm engaging you in conversation, I could say, hey, what brings you here? That's the what. When you answer, I could say, oh, why is that important? Or why do you find that interesting? That's the so what. And then after that, I can ask a question like, oh, so what more are you going to do? Or what are you going to do next? Or do you want to join me and go over here? So I've got the now what is a question. As with anything that you're trying to learn, you have to practice it. When you read something or listen to a podcast, pause it, stop your reading, think, what was it about? Why is it important to me? And how can I use it? By drilling it, it becomes more natural. When we're in small talk situations, we often initiate with trite, very common phrases. How are you? What brings you here? What do you do? These are simple, reflexive ways to get started, but they actually don't take you very far. I am a big fan of initiating through questions, but through questions that connect to the particular context and environment that I'm in. Just the other day, I was in a situation for small talk, and the very first thing I did, I came up to somebody I didn't know, and I said, "This is amazing to me. There are more people in this room wearing blue shirts than I think I've seen in a long time." And the person said, "You know what? You're right. That's really interesting." And all of a sudden, the conversation was off and running. All I did was notice something in the environment. Initiating with something that piques somebody's curiosity, something that might be highlighting something that's not known or commonly discussed in the moment, can really invite people in versus, "Hi, how are you?" And they say, "Fine." Well, now I'm back to where I started, and it's even more awkward, right? Perhaps more challenging than initiating small talk is getting out of small talk. Many of us rely on biology. "Oh, I'm thirsty. I'm going to go get a drink. I'm hungry," or "I need to go to the bathroom." Biology is not necessarily the best exit for these circumstances. I love an approach I learned from Rachel Greenwald. It's called the white flag approach. If you know anything about auto racing, prior to the last lap, the final lap, they wave a white flag to signal to all the drivers that the race is ending. As you're drawing near to the end of the conversation, either because you need to leave, or you want to leave, or the conversation has sort of run its course, you signal that. You say, "I need to go in a moment. But," and this is where you ask one last question, provide one last bit of feedback. So you continue the conversation on for a little bit. So it might sound something like this. "I need to get going because there's some friends over there I need to meet. But before I go, I want to know just a little bit more about that trip you were telling me about to Hawaii." And together you can draw the conversation to an end rather than you abruptly saying, "Oh, I need to go to the bathroom," or "Wow, that looks like good food over there." It's just a much better, cleaner way to end a small talk conversation.
So that was Matt Abrams, to get good at small talk and even enjoy it. Oh, man, I have to go to the bathroom. Oh, no, wait a sec. You don't do that. Or, "Oh, look, there's food over there. Oh, I love Doritos." Listening to that, some tips I've never heard before, like small talk. I mean, you could come up with stupid stuff and just ask people. In general, my go-to, my DJ name, which came out of a small talk opportunity, not Ted. This drives my friends nuts because I really don't do it anymore. But generally, I would go up to people and be like, "Hey, my name's James, not Ted," and they're like, "Did I call you Ted?" I'm like, "No, don't call me Ted." And that's 15 minutes of me being weird and funny. That's my idea. Don't steal that. Come up with your own thing. So, I mean, you can have go-to stuff that you can use in small talk, especially if you get nervous in social situations. One-on-one, in a group of people, generally, for me, I think it's low pressure. You're not the center of attention. You can just like riff off what other people are saying. So, if you have problems with talking with people in one-on-one, just get in a group of people. Then you're not the focus of a one-on-one conversation. You can just throw in your ideas once in a while. And plus, you could probably learn how to talk by watching other people talk. So, that's my tips. So, we're going to play a little musical track, and then everyone get excited. I'm going to play a little record diatribe that I recorded actually this afternoon, wrote a few days ago, just talking about this and that. I'll set it up after the music. So, this is Radio Lyceum. We're at WREV FM Burlington. Like I said, if you want to contact me through email, you can contact me through an email I set up, radiolyceum@protonmail.com. That's radiolyceum@protonmail.com, all one word. So let's go play some music. This is Mother of Pearl by Scribble. Thank you. I love that track so much. I'm sorry I have to fade it out, but 17 minutes long. Scribble Mother Pearl. It's a cover of It's a cover of a 70s band that Brian Eno played in. I'll remember when I stop thinking about it. But So the track that I'm bringing up is a little thing that I pre-record and talk about. It talks about depression and isolation, so just fair warning. If you're feeling depressed and you have a thing, the local Howard Center, you can reach out to 802-488-777 for Chittenden County. So just a little setup on the stuff I'm talking about. So the me writing this kind of was brought about by a talk that I saw, or a podcast that Rod Putman was on, and people talking about, it's like, what's causing this isolation? Why are people pulling away? I mean, in a situation where people are like, hey man, come hang out, and you're like, ugh, I really don't want to. So I talk about some of the causes for some of that. There's some theories about where depression comes from. It's not, there's lots of different theories about how depression comes from. So this is not 100% scientific fact. It's just one of the theories that's out there. And also kind of touch on about media and the extremes in media and feeding on the conflict. I just want to also make the point that I'm not saying should avoid conflict, but I'm just saying be aware of what conflict in your social media or in media in general from the very beginning, how that affects your brain and how that could affect how you interact with the world. So let's get into it. This is the first thing I recorded, and as I always tell my friends, like, the last thing I'm least qualified to do is a talk show, but I think we did okay. You can call me 656-4399 if you have any questions about this or make any comments. So that said, let's isolation causes. Is an attention-seeking form of art, and attention is its currency. This is not a new idea, but now we see it in this most distilled form in social media. Conflicts and outrage demands our attention from our social brains like nothing else. So if you wanted to create a perfect brew to demand our attention, what would you need? Something controversial that checks all the outrage and conflict buttons. What if we throw in a dash of conspiracy theory? Something the man doesn't want you to know? I've got a brew that can't be ignored. Should we avoid all conflict, bury heads in the sand, ignore all information that the man doesn't want us to know? Of course not. This is what they don't want you to know. That this cocktail of conflict, outrage, and hidden knowledge is a secret to keeping you coming back for more. So if you see something with these ingredients mixed into one, it's like the Doritos of the information world, genetically engineered to demand our attention. This is not new, though. Media has always found ways to hack our brains and seek attention. Since the invention of the printing press, society had to filter out the that the tension market dangles in front of us. It's no surprise that social brains seek out conflict, because in the past, as well as now, we had to know where danger was coming from, especially if it involved social conflict. We need to know how to avoid it or smooth it out over in our own groups. There are many theories about why depression exists, and its prevalence in society suggests some sort of evolutionary adaptation. One such theory is depression is a response to major loss, a loss of a close friend, a child, a relative, or even a social isolation event. When we experience a major conflict or with our social group, we tend to pull away and our brains enter a rumination cycle. Often, novel solutions or self-reflection can change the behavior that caused the major loss. Or we might learn to change our outlook to adapt to the new world after the loss. This is one theory why depression exists, often paired with self-isolation to cope with a crisis. So our brains are maladapted to the way we've structured the modern world. We seek out conflict because in the past, we need to know how to deal with these things before they hit us unaware. We often seek it out in our fictional stories and myths. In our fictional stories and myths, the conflict resolves itself and the pain resolves, pushing those buttons that we love so much. Social media's all-knowing algorithm, trained on trillions of interactions, knows we love conflict and seek it out. If it's real, we really seek it out. We need to know these things. Give us that Dorito-coded knowledge. What does the brain do with this torrent of unresolved conflict? It needs to process it. But how many news stories have you seen that wrap up with an easy solution at the end? Or go back and say, oh, the thing they said was an issue, we solved it, or reduced it by 90%. Never, right? Because when things get fixed and everything is good, it doesn't demand our attention. And as we know, that does not grab our attention to sell rug pull and crypto. Conflict captures our attention because we had to for survival. The human brain evolved to prioritize conflict and social threats because our survival depended upon it. As I said before, our ancestors had to monitor conflicts, both physical and social, to avoid exclusion, violence, or loss of resources. Social rejection in particular is treated the same way it processes physical pain. Conflict signals potential danger to our social standing. Now, chronic conflict exposure overloads the stress system. If the conflict was temporary, we could recover. But chronic exposure, like nonstop media conflict, keeps our stress response permanently activated, leading to burnout and depression. Cortisol, the stress hormone, is activated to prepare us for fight or flight, or to promote a reaction. In small doses, this is adaptive and helps us respond to immediate threats. However, prolonged exposure to conflict, whether from nonstop media outrage or social media fights, keeps the area of the brain that deals with such interactions on all the time, which can lead to emotional numbness, where the brain dampens response to protect itself, a loss of pleasure. Chronic stress reduces the dopamine function, which is associated with pleasure. Motivation depletion. The brain signals a shutdown to conserve energy. As Podolsky in his 1994 book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, quote, "Our stress response was built for acute crises, not for the never-ending psychological threats we now face," unquote. An example, a Twitter argument about politics triggers anger, stress, and a cortisol spike. Instead of resolving the issue, the algorithm feeds more conflict, keeping the stress response active. Over time, the brain suppresses emotional energy, leading to exhaustion, withdrawal, and depressive symptoms. So there's a connection between conflict, learned helplessness, and depression. When people repeatedly face conflict with no resolution, they develop learned helplessness, key driver of depression. In a questionable experiment in 1975 by Seligman, dogs exposed to inescapable shocks stopped trying to escape, even when given the opportunity. human peril is this. If we see constant conflict, division, and negativity, they start believing nothing I will do will fix things. The world is broken. Interacting with people is pointless. Seligman in 1991 writes in Learn Optimism, quote, "Depression arrives when people feel powerless in the face of persistent negative experiences," unquote. So we'll take a modern example where someone watches daily media conflict, political fights, economic doom, and culture wars. They start feeling overwhelmed, unable to change anything. Instead of engaging socially, they withdraw, reinforcing depression and loneliness. So media conflict often exacerbates social withdrawal and also can worsen depression. Constant exposure to media-fueled conflicts makes people more socially distrustful, less willing to engage with people they disagree with, more isolated, which worsens mental health, can pull people into the rumination depressive cycle. The social isolation cycle works like this. See conflict everywhere on the news, Twitter, YouTube debates. Avoid social situations to prevent stress or confrontation. Isolation will reduce social bonding hormones like oxytocin and serotonin. And lack of social connections worsens depression, leading to more withdrawal. As Cacioppo explains in his 2008 book, Loneliness, quote, "Loneliness is not just a symptom of depression. It is the cause. Social withdrawal rewires the brain towards anxiety and negativity," unquote. Typical example, let's take someone who gets into a heated debate about social issues. Instead of resolving anything, they leave the conversation feeling angry, hopeless, and exhausted. They may avoid discussions altogether. Then they start avoiding people and eventually stop socializing completely, spiraling down the depressive rumination cycle. Media can promote social isolation either directly, either by breeding mistrust, or promoting you'd be better alone. You don't need other people. So what can we do? This isn't something new. The media before the age of the printing press found ways to hack our brains and seek attention. The Hammer of Witches kicked off the witch trials in medieval Europe. It was wildly popular, combining the perfect blend of conflict, which is poisoning cattle and stealing babies, and hidden knowledge. These women are living in your communities, right under your nose. This, along with real conflicts in society, brought social bonds and communities to their knees in the medieval period. How did they deal with these issues? Not by endlessly pouring more information about real and fake conflicts. Not doom scrolling. Instead, they forged social communities to solve the real issues of the day and dismiss the fake conflicts flooding their communities with the invention of the printing press. In Enlightenment, where people questioned dogma that fueled endless wars, questioned the authority of kings and lords who made all the decisions that pushed us apart for their own gain, it fostered a mingling of people across classes and cultures and brought us solutions. Imperfect though they were, that ended slavery and sparked the greatest flourishing humanity has ever seen. Before this, half the babies didn't survive until childhood, and endless pointless wars decimated the population. Later on, the second wave of isolation in America was brought on by economic inequality, political polarization, and a culture shift toward individualism in the late 1800s. It brought our country to the edge of destruction. In response, society began building social organizations like the Boy Scouts, Rotary Club, and many more at a feverish pace. The radio pushed destructive nationalism and the rise of fascism worldwide, contributed to the start of World War I, Hitler, and World War II. But radio also helped bring us together into larger communities for good. Jazz and blues, for example, broke down race barriers that slavery had put up on America and beyond. Society has a way of responding to each crisis with new social organizations, often co-opting the media of destruction for reconstruction. Media can cut both ways, for good and for bad. TV brought a new paradigm. pushing us away from each other again. And with each new medium, new methods of organizing emerged: punk rock, disco, house music, skateboarders, and more. These new cultures brought new hope, and TV told stories that brought us closer together, by also pushing us apart by feeding media's insatiable need for attention. Crime began to fall after the shock of the 1960s. West and East Germany reunited, and apartheid ended. In the 90s, a new era of hope began. The end of all conflict was in sight. Then came 24-hour news, partisan radio, and political system that focused on winner-takes-all mentality, where in the end, we all lose. The internet brought new hope for breaking down barriers, with in-depth knowledge accessible to everyone. But the tension kaji struck again. Conflict, not solutions. Lies told as hidden knowledge sells. Your doctor doesn't want you to know this hidden trick. The battle over insult this BS topic gets heated. You won't believe what this person said. On and on it goes. We can all get in social isolation feedback loops. There are methods to get out of them. We may be experiencing a similar crisis today, but there is hope. We can build social organizations that focus on fun, creating solutions, and cuts across political divides. Let's forge communities that bring us back together, face to face. Make media that works for us and does not swallow us up in an insatiable need for attention. If we do, we might just reach the next enlightenment to hold us up until the next unsolvable crisis that hits our timeline. So that's a little thing I recorded actually today. And so basically it was in response to Robert Putman did like a podcast recently, and one of the questions he really couldn't answer was like, okay, where's this social isolation coming from? So we're extremely social species, especially if you read the histories back in the Middle Ages, back to people. One of the most shocking fact I remember from the Middle Ages is like when you went in, you went to the inn, everyone shared the same bed. So there was like, 10 people in the same bed. I'm like, can you imagine going to the inn and being like, oh, sure, we'll share your bed with 10 other people. That'd be fun. And I was trying to make the point of like, it's just a theory. And I mean, other people have had this theory, and there's always been, there's many books that talk about how media, when new media comes, is usually brought like a lot of change and chaos when it comes in the printing press, the radio, TV, and now the internet. So, but tying that back in with where you see conflict and basically it stresses your system out, and generally you can get into that loop where if you get in that conflict loop with no resolution, it kind of can make you withdraw a little bit from the world and other people. So, and